So, we're going to do this in English tonight, so it will be simple. If anyone... Translation? not translation, just, okay. If anyone has a problem with a specific word or term or sentence, just raise your hand and we'll just do immediate translation method. And we just gathered quite many questions we've got and try to group them into topics, and we will try as best as we can to answer. So we'll just dig them randomly. Some answers might be more complex or elaborated. Some answers might be very short. It depends. So don't expect always something very developed. Okay. So this is a question about what was said today, I think today, about the inner child that is already, that already does not exist. And that if we feel the inner child, it means that we are clinging to something. So,
in therapy, as many of you know, there's inner child work, which means that we remember perhaps an issue from the past that's been painful and difficult. The way that we then respond is rather beautiful. So what we do in a therapeutic sense is we are providing the love and the care to that child or to that idea or memory of the child who perhaps did not get her or his needs met as a young person. So in a sense, what the therapist will ask the person to do, and I know there are probably many more skilled therapists than me here in terms of inner child work, but is to bring love and care and kindness to that memory. And the memory often comes with an intensity of emotion. If you are in the process of doing inner child work with your therapist, please don't stop based on anything I said today. When we look with a Dharma perspective, as we heard today, we can have some issues from the past. We remember the issues from the past in the present. We see the thoughts, we feel the feelings with love and warmth and care. This is the meditator's method. But we also see when we understand what's happened and it's time to let go. So that we're not living our entire life with consciousness colored by a difficulty from the past. And it's the same with many other issues in therapy. For example, if someone had an issue with a sexual assault or trauma, the person does the work with the therapist, but hopefully reaches a point where they're set free, where there's a way of being with the past, remembering the past, not denying it, not suppressing it, knowing it, yet being free from it. No longer being bound to whatever it is that has happened in the past. So this is the path of healing, and sometimes we need to know that we need therapy, and sometimes we need to know that we need the meditator's mind and the meditator's approach, where we really, really know we have finished our therapy, we're done with this issue, and we no longer need to be bound to it. So that was my point today.
Where should we direct attention more, to the belly or to the nose?
There's no one answer for that. What's important is to be in contact with the breath and to feel the breath in the body. And sometimes the breath is best felt in the belly. Sometimes the breath is best felt in the nose. And sometimes the breath is best felt in the whole body. We can play with the breath. We can explore different ways of feeling the breath in the body. It can be a very, very playful and interesting exploration.
This is a question about energy, curiosity. How do you really get there? Or what can you do? Because I see that sometimes it's not that I have this enthusiasm, but it's more I need it or I have to do it so life will be better. How do we bring a lighter attitude, a more pleasant attitude, and really do something out of joy and not from being too serious and feel enjoyment? This is more or less the question.
This one's yours, Willie.
Okay. So I guess there are many, first of all, there are many technical ways we can use to bring up energy, and maybe we can talk about the meditation itself, that there are all kinds of things we can do to approach it with more energy. A lot of it comes through movement in different ways. That can be, if we sit, we can do something before we sit that might make the energy flow a bit and do it until we feel some kind of lightness, some kind of joy. And usually it can happen quite quickly after 5 or 10 or 20 minutes of movement. Could be jogging, could be dancing, could be yoga, could be anything. Just maybe walking barefoot on the grass or climbing a tree or anything that just makes you feel a bit happy. And it's always quite amazing to see how accessible it is, more than we think, with just some kind of using of the body. Could be also from doing something which is very physical, like working in the garden or making bread or making pottery or carpentry or anything that you work with your hands. Also many times brings some kind of joy. Could be also just from being in nature. So there are all kinds of things that probably you all know that can just elevate a little bit and move a little bit our energy before we sit. And gradually we can inquire and try and find our habits, our techniques, our ways. And it's quite important to try and sit in some kind of a balanced or slightly positive energy. Can help a lot for the concentration to build. It's very hard to build a meditative concentration when we are really agitated, really upset, really feel down. So it's quite important. Another thing that we can think of is related more to the meditation itself. We can try to maybe do all kinds of mental exercises and reflections that can make us feel a bit more energetic and happy. It could be all kinds of heart practices. Maybe some of you know and have more experience in that, some of you less, but there are so many guided meditations online in the Tovana website and in many other places. So gratitude practices are very, very helpful in that sense, and loving kindness practices of sympathetic joy, reflecting on the joy of others and bringing, becoming joyful out of that. Maybe people we love that are happy and that can make us happy. The third thing I can think of is maybe our approach during the meditation. And this is something very subtle, but it has to do with how we bring the awareness or how we pay attention, because paying attention can be an action, something we do, something we, like we try to grasp the breath or go through something and move something out of our way, like fear or pain, try to really push it away. And we think this is paying attention, but actually we discover that there is a lot of doing there. Or, and Radha mentioned the image of the chord of the guitar or any other instrument that we try to, and this is a very beautiful image from the Pali Canon, trying to really make it not too tight, not too loose. So we really, if we tend to do that, and many of us tend to do that, we try to approach the meditation as a work, as a project, as a, something to achieve, going through some phases towards a result. This usually creates kind of contraction and makes us usually feel frustrated, unsatisfied, and exhausted. So there is some kind of an going, like taking an inner step backwards and just relaxing. You don't have to do the meditation. Don't have to do the paying attention. We just need to pay attention. And it doesn't require any effort. The only effort we need to put is just the effort to remember or not to forget that we are trying to apply mindfulness or pay attention. But when we are there and we're with the object, it's practically zero effort. There is no effort needed to pay attention. And you can just feel it now. Like if you pay attention to seeing, can you pay attention to the fact that you are seeing? Is that difficult? No, no need of any effort. So this lightness of effort also can help us, can bring some energy. I can think of all kinds of other things, but maybe we need to get to other answers. Maybe you want to add? No?
Speaking of lightness, it really helps to take ourselves lightly, a bit of humor. We see our mind doing its crazy thing, then instead of, you know, reacting in frustration and criticism, can we just laugh at it? It really is so amusing, the crazy stories and loops and somersaults that our mind does. And all our minds do it. If we can just remember, you know, that it's something so universal and so not personal, and just bring a smile to there. And I'm reminded that quite a few years ago, I was teaching with another of the Tovana teachers, Sandhya, and somebody asked the question, how do you not identify with the mind? And her answer was brilliant, so I'm going to share it with you. She said, well, just imagine that your mind is your neighbor's mind. Ah, poor thing. So, yeah. And it's sort of like approaching also practice in the spirit of, you know, opening to the mystery of life. This is so incredibly mysterious, this thing that, you know, we're sort of, we call me. And life in general, you know, just looking at the sky, looking at the stars, I mean, God, what is happening on this kind of, in this existence? And so just remembering that, because we tend to, you know, come to practice and come to life in general with so much agenda and so much knowing mind, and kind of just sort of, yeah, inviting ourselves into that sort of childlike curiosity. You know, oh, what is this? What is going on here? Whew. That brings energy and joy.
The next question is about anxiety. And and sometimes I feel anxiety and stress, and I guess many of us can identify with this sentence.
Yes.
And sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's better. And the question is, what can I do when anxiety or anxiety thoughts take over, anxiety takes over, and I can't calm down? And a very interesting question, are any anxious thoughts important?
Okay, shall I begin? I've got a microphone. So when we feel anxiety, it usually begins with a sensation somewhere in the body. In the pit of the stomach, for example, is very typical, but it can be somewhere else. So there's the initial feeling tone of the sensation. This is not actually the anxiety itself. The anxiety is added to that with our beliefs and ideas and thoughts. So the anxiety is constructed based on our fear of the future, fear of what might happen. There's all kinds of different fears. Fear of death, fear of the dark, fear. A woman I was once working with as a psychologist had fear of driving downhill. Another one had fear of going through a doorway that was a particular color. So there are all kinds of fears that can emerge. We need to understand them. And the way we work with them as a meditation practitioner is absolutely brilliant. It's the shortcut method. We come directly to the sensation in the body. But the attention needs to be very light and kind and gentle. We track the shifting, changing sensation. So we track it. And it might move in the body. It might go somewhere else. It might be pulsing. It might be a tight knot. Whatever is happening, we just stay with it. Loving, kind attention is essential. Then what we do is we ask the question, is there a belief that's associated with this sensation in the body? Then we just wait. And very often, the belief will come. It'll just emerge. And then we can begin to see how our anxiety is constructed. Here I should think of an example. Okay. This is an example from my life. I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, I was in India walking down a narrow alleyway at night. I hear a pack of dogs coming behind me, barking. I have to confess, I'm a bit scared of barking, biting dogs sometimes. So they're coming after me, right, in the dark, on a narrow Indian street. There's no doorways, there's just walls. The thought process went something like this. Oh, the dog is going to bite me. Oh, dogs in India have rabies. I'm going to end up needing to be evacuated to Singapore Hospital. Oh, I'm going to die and never see my children again. Like, this is the dramatic and catastrophic thinking that fuels the anxiety. So we have the feeling of the pit in the stomach based on the sound of the dogs barking, and then we have all the thoughts that get added to it. And I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you know the story where we catastrophize with the thinking world. And before long I was thinking, I'm never going to see my children again. And my Indian friend just said, oh Radha, you just pretend to pick up a rock and then they just leave you alone. But I didn't know that. So, of course, I was incredibly worried. So the anxiety is constructed with the beliefs and the thoughts, the imagination, the ideas. It's constructed with memory from the past. So we have to see into it, and we see that anxiety also relies on this separate sense of self. So when we deconstruct that, when we see the emptiness of the thought and the belief, and sometimes the ridiculousness of it, that thoughts are illogical, then the whole notion of the anxiety begins to collapse. It's deconstructed. That is one way to deal with the anxiety. The other way is to turn towards our freedom. And when we turn towards our freedom, the anxiety itself ceases. So when we just know in the moment, oh, I'm quite free now, I'm quite at peace, any moment during the day, then anxiety is absent. So when we face our fears, our anxiety begins to cease because we deconstruct the whole notion. When we face our freedom, our fear ceases. Sometimes the question said, is there an anxious thought that is useful? Yes. If my child was about to run onto the road and a car was coming past and my heart jumped and I grabbed the child, yes. The thought, oh, the car's coming, there's danger, do something, is useful. But much of our anxiety is totally unnecessary. It adds to, it adds this whole level of mental anguish and distress to the actuality of life. Much of it is just constructed and formed and imposed and overlain upon the reality. Feel free to add something.
There is a question I'll just answer in one word. Is it recommended to be in radical acceptance and patient inquiry towards thoughts that are not beneficial and repetitive and circular, Magaliot? So, yes, of course. I have a wish to let go of my story, the story of my life, meaning not to get attached to it, and still, it's my story of my life. How do you let go of my story without losing my identity, the colors of my character, my persona? My story is not my identity, but I find it really hard to let go or separate from me from it.
Okay. I used to be a storyteller in my previous, something, reincarnation, in this life. And stories are beautiful. And we all have a story. We're all living a story. The Buddha has a beautiful, there's a beautiful sutta in which the Buddha tells his story of seeking. It's called the Noble Search. And he tells his story, how he started out and the journey he went through and to his realization. Letting go of our story doesn't mean that the story doesn't exist. It just means that we're not defined by the story or just by the story. The story is not who we are. We're not trapped by the story. We have a tendency, you know, we know the story, all the things that happened to us, and we have a tendency to sort of tell ourselves and tell others and tell our therapists and tell the story again and again and again. It becomes very solidified in our minds, in our being. And we really kind of feel that we are this person, this character in the story, in a very, as I said, in a very solidified way. And this we want to investigate. We want to see that we are not the story. Yes, things happen to us, but the story isn't who we are. And that the same things that happen to us also can be reframed and they can be told in many, many different ways. I mean, the Buddha, you know, he had a very controlling father and his mother died when he was young. He could have told this very sad story about himself. But he told his story as a noble search. And it's really beautiful to kind of look at our life journeys in those eyes. We're all on a noble search. And all, you know, being here on this retreat is part of that noble search. And all the things that happened that led to that. It's all part of the story that ultimately leads us to letting go of the story, which is really beautiful, I think. So letting go of the story doesn't mean at all that we become this kind of colorless, characterless, you know, bland, uninteresting, an everything creature. It just means that, you know, we're free of the story that defines us in a particular way and that binds us in a particular way. And that we're also much bigger than the story. There may be beautiful stories that we tell about ourselves, but we're bigger than those as well. They're only a part of who we are. And I mentioned that I used to be a storyteller, yeah. And I told, like, for years I was kind of moving through libraries and classrooms and nursery schools telling stories to children. That was how I made my living. And I really remember how in almost every storytelling session that I did, you know, the children would be listening with wide eyes and open mouths. And I'd finish the story. I'd say, and that's the end of the story. And usually I'd ring a bell. And there'd always be the kid who'd say, is that a true story? And so, yeah, we have all these stories about things that have happened to us and stories that there are the stories that run through our minds and, you know, they kind of clutter our psyches. And so those we can certainly kind of practice asking, is that a true story? You know. But also all the stories, you know, all the stories of things that happened to us along our lives that we've sort of kind of crystallized into pictures of who we are and what our life is. You know, the question, is that a true story? And the story is never the whole story. Asipur wa fam lo kol asipur, whatever story it is. Sad or beautiful, empowering or belittling, it's never the whole story. The whole story is so much vaster and immeasurable. So, anything to add?
Yes, just a little. I love the wisdom from stories. And in my Dharma teaching, as you've heard, I love to tell stories. In Australia, our indigenous people say, if you don't have story, you don't have heart. So I think that's really precious. And it's important to understand when the self-narrative is problematic and when the story actually reveals extraordinary wisdom. And so when the self narrative that we have is leading to suffering and difficult mind states and a difficult life, then we do need to let it go. We do need to cut through it. But when the story is revealing extraordinary wisdom, then we take it. We take the pearl from the story and let it sink in. So I love story because I think the stories that I try and tell anyway in my talks and at other times really I use to illustrate a Dharma point. And stories have a lot of heart, stories have love, stories connect us, and stories bring joy. I love them. Yes.
What is the place of personal love in a world that has no self, meaning love for family or partners? Well, first of all, I'm not sure it's so accurate to say that the world does not have a self. It's also not accurate to say that the world has a self, and I think we discussed that at a certain point, that the truth is somewhere in between. And we might ask, what is the place or how love looks like in a world of freedom, of a liberated heart and mind? How can they, or how they behave in close relationships? And I think from my experience, as years go by, relationships that just improve, because what we sometimes call love actually is a mix of maybe 10% or 20% pure love and many other things like attachment, fear, expectations, stories, all kinds of things that are not really like pure, true, unconditioned love, as the Dharma suggests or invites us to explore and discover. So what I see that as years go by, and there is less fear, less expectations, and less criticism, and less disappointments, and all those noises or irrelevant parts, relationships just become better. Because, and I think maybe the core issue is fear. You know, when relationship has less and less fear in it, it's more free, and we are less worried about what might happen, and we're just busy with what happens now and how we can be less selfish and more into what we can give, what we can do, how we can contribute, and not so much about what's in it for me, what do I get, and what's wrong with the other person, etc., etc. So actually being less, maybe not less self, but less selfish or less self-centered, maybe that's a better way to put it, I think we can all agree that should bring good things to relationships. So I wouldn't worry about that, actually. So next question is how to deal with addiction? That's for you.
Okay. For many years I worked with people with addictions. It's important, first of all, to see the addictive behaviors as a symptom of something else, and to look deeply at the underlying mechanism that's keeping the addiction in place. I would say, from my experience of working with hundreds of people, that a lot of addictive behaviors and difficulties come about through an inability to deal with the feeling world constructively. And because the feeling world is perhaps painful, there's a reaching to a drug or to some other kind of substance to numb the feeling world, to switch off. To numb, yeah. Yeah. So the way that I worked with people was, of course, in a very caring, a very loving, a very compassionate way. I think that's important. In the world of addiction treatment in Australia, certainly a couple of decades ago, there was really kind of harsh treatment where the person was kind of blamed for having the addiction. And that is just, in my view, absurd. So the way that I worked was to, I guess in a way it was teaching people the Dharma without saying so, but it was really getting people to understand the mechanism of mind. So there's the feeling tone of the experience, pleasant or unpleasant. There's the, based on that, there's desire arises. With the desire comes the clinging. And with the clinging, of course, comes the wanting to become. So the wanting to become numb, the wanting to become drunk, the wanting to switch off from life, the wanting, and so on. So the wanting mind needs to be seen. Addiction is mostly self-sabotaging behaviors that aren't stopped, if you like. So the self-sabotaging mechanism harms and hurts the person and, of course, families and others. So the definition of addiction really is that we keep doing something that we know harms us and we can't find that point of breakthrough. With the people that I worked with, I worked very much with the thought world. You have the thought, I want to use a drug, I want to get high or whatever it is. That doesn't mean that you necessarily have to do it if you can see that you know where it leads. And I was working at the time with people with very serious heroin addictions or addictions to speed or cocaine or other substances, also to alcohol. And these were people who had at least a history of at least 2 years of uncontrollable kind of use. And most of them had reached a point where they decided that they really needed help. And so I worked in this therapeutic community, a residential setting for people with addictions, and they were the most fantastic group of people, honestly. I fell in love with them all. And they began to see, or together we began to see, all the underlying issues that led to the addiction. And one of the studies that I did as part of my therapeutic training was in anxiety. And what I discovered that about two-thirds of the people in this center where I was working could have been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder prior to the drug use. So anxiety and depression were certainly two things that fueled drug use. And of course, the other very big issues in the background were a background of trauma or some kind of assault or, you know, very serious issue. So essentially, the work that I did was being with the person, identifying the issues, what could be changed, what could be worked on, what they wanted to let go of. And extraordinary shifts and changes occurred. I had to think about why is this working? Because I worked with people with who had borderline personality disorders or were considered, you know, almost untreatable, that some of them had very long histories of very outrageous and self-destructive behavior. And what I decided, what I realized in the end, was that it was actually unconditional love. It was meeting the person with love and care that was the healing mechanism. So if you have someone in your family, if you have someone you know who is really struggling with addiction, the recipe is compassion, love, care and understanding, and then some skillful looking at what the actual issues are that are keeping the destructive tendencies in place. So this is how we work. We work with love and compassion, essentially. Yes.
Yeah.
About.
He said the severe addictions, but actually he meant the more daily.
Yeah. About daily life addictions. It is exactly the same mechanism of mind. We need to see the feeling, we need to see the desire, we need to see our aversion and attraction. We then need to see whether we act on an impulse or not. Because we have a desire doesn't mean we have to have the 10 spoons of sugar in the coffee. So it's exactly the same movement of mind with daily life addictions, food, sugar, sex. It's to see the movement of mind. And we don't have to be bound to desire. We can be steady in the face of it. We can be steady in the face of our likes, dislikes, attractions, and aversions.
I want to add something from my experience teaching meditation in prison for people in a group for recovery from addictions. And one of the things I noticed that actually it's a hindrance for any transformation, for the transformation or change in life, is the identity of I am addicted. So in one sense, it's helpful because it means taking responsibility. But from another perspective, really holding on strongly to the identity that I am addicted or I am anything really makes it very difficult to let go and move on to something else or open up to new possibilities. So that's also, I think, very important. Okay, next question is, how do we practice forgiveness, meaning forgiving for someone who harmed you or hurt you? I'll be happy we can speak about forgiveness and pain.
Forgiveness and pain. Well, first of all, when somebody hurts us, it's painful. Simply painful, and it's hard to forgive when we feel harmed or hurt. And on a very first relational level, when we are hurt, when we feel hurt by someone, we first have to really turn towards that pain. We can often, especially if, you know, we're on some kind of path that has put ideas into our heads that it's right to forgive and we have to be forgiving and, you know, forgiveness is what should be done and so forth. We can put a lot of pressure on ourselves. And the pressure will probably come with criticism. Why aren't I forgiving? And what's wrong with me? And so forth and so forth. And so if we've been hurt and we're in pain, we have to first turn towards that pain in ourselves with a lot of compassion and a lot of understanding and a lot of softness and really kind of be in touch with that place that was hurt, perhaps not felt, that it wasn't seen or not respected or whatever, or abandoned, or all the various ways that we can feel hurt And I'm talking now about kind of the kinds of hurts that we experience, you know, in our relationships and our interactions, our human interactions. I'm less talking about the kind of major things that can happen, like abuse or being attacked in this or that way. So yeah, we have to first turn towards our, you know, towards the hurt that we feel, and just really bring a lot of softness and compassion to it. And at the same time, we do want to be very aware of the stories that are accompanying the incident, kind of the mind saying what, you know, saying what happened, what he, she did, what I should have, what I shouldn't have, what, you know, just be very kind of aware of, yeah, the way the stories are kind of adding on to the pain or constructing the whole sense of what happened in our minds. And when we're meeting ourselves with a lot of softness and compassion and understanding, and yet at the same time kind of being aware of the stories that are kind of accompanying the incident and not kind of buying into them and in a kind of not just being aware of them and not kind of seeing them as ultimately true, which we tend to do. Yeah. Somebody hurts us and we kind of, again, the self kicks in and, you know, here we are, this hurt person, and the other person is, you know, the harmful person. And, you know, I told my own story when I gave my Dharma talk about this happening to me. This is what happens. And so we want to really be clear about, you know, just see clearly what is happening. And when we do that, when we're kind of very soft and tender and understanding of ourselves, but still seeing clearly through the stories, then we can see more clearly into the conditioning that kind of may have led to this, my own conditioning, the other person's conditioning. We can kind of understand that, yeah, this is life kind of doing what it does. It's less personal. And then forgiveness can happen more naturally in its own time. Again, we don't want to push ourselves. We don't want to press ourselves, but we do want to understand that ultimately it's in our, you know, it's so much more freeing to forgive. It's not pleasant to walk around in this kind of unforgiving stance. It's just so much more happy and joyful and freeing. And yeah, it just opens up so much more possibilities of moving freely through life and joyfully through life. Yeah, anything to add?
Just briefly, a few years ago, a woman came for an inquiry in Australia. And she was a beautiful young woman, and she revealed rather bravely in the inquiry that as a child she had been sexually assaulted. And she said, "But Radha, I just can't forgive. I just can't forgive." And I said, "You don't have to." So she went away and told her husband what I'd said. And he said, "Oh, surely Radha didn't say that." She came back to another retreat a few months later, and she came up for an inquiry, and she just said, "I have to report what happened." She said, "As soon as you told me, I didn't have to forgive. The pressure was off my mind to forgive." And then she said, "I have been flooded with forgiveness." She said, "Forgiveness has just been coming through my whole body, and I no longer feel bound to this past incident." It was just beautiful. So sometimes we need to take the pressure off and not demand that we somehow be saintly and forgiving. And when we do that, the very natural process of forgiveness can begin. Next question.
This question is about the reality and suffering outside. What can help keeping or maintaining hope and optimism? And when we meet a difficult reality, what can support us to be with humility and softness with it?
That's for you.
Hope and optimism, I'm not sure this is what I'm so interested in. That's not what really supports me, to be honest. My resource, and this is what I also try to tell others when they ask me what to do and how to deal with this situation, which can be always this situation. And we thought about that Radha, every time she comes to Israel, there is a situation. So, yeah, so for me, the ground is just my trust in my growing ability to be and to accept reality as it is right now. And as I do it more and more and more, year after year, I get more and more confident that this is possible for me in more and more situations, including difficult ones. And then I can look forward and assume in a quite good way, which is getting better and better, that no matter what will happen, this will be, and this is the only sure thing I can say, that at any future moment, things will be as they are. This is the only certainty we have. And it's very meaningful because we can be with it. And then when we can be with it, this is the ground for our actions, for our responses, for our decisions, for anything we do. But it comes from a ground of radical acceptance of reality as it is. Because when we were born, no one gave us a note, a warranty that says this life will have no challenges, no difficulty, no problems, no crisis. Because it's impossible to promise something like that. The moment we are born, there will be dukkha, there will be suffering, there will be struggles and problems. This is life. And it's not anybody's fault. So for me, the support is just the ability to accept without any conditions anything that happens. And then from that ground, see what is required, what is asking to be done, what is the compassionate, the loving, the brave, the patient action to be done. And sometimes it's doing nothing is the right thing to do, and sometimes it's to do something or many things.
Another resource, of course, is equanimity, being rather steady in the face of everything that occurs. And equanimity is a divinity of the heart, really. And when we're really with the difficult situations, with steadiness, we no longer add to them the additional layer of our anguish and fear and despair. And with that clarity and steadiness, things don't seem so bad sometimes. A friend of mine really, really embodied equanimity. He was a Dharma teacher in both the Zen tradition and the Insight tradition, and he had a cancer that was fatal, really. He was sick for a long time. He was totally uncomplaining. He was steady with it. He practiced. At times when he was in hospital and in a lot of pain, he said he remembered the sutta of the Buddhas to Anattapindika, where in fact, it wasn't the Buddha, it was Ananda or someone, came to Anathapindika as he was dying and in pain and said to let go of this, to let go of that, and went through all the different, let go of the senses, let go of any kind of clinging. And so he would just sit there and or lie there in his hospital bed reflecting on these treasures that are in the Dharma about how to face death fearlessly. It was extraordinary. And on the very last day that I saw him, he was sitting up in bed and another Dharma teacher and I, a friend, went to see him. And he was sitting there and he was quite yellow by this stage because he had liver cancer, but he was full of love, absolutely full of love. And he kept grabbing us and hugging us and kissing us and saying, I love you, you know. And he did this to me first and I thought, oh, my goodness, his wife is in the next room. This is going to be a bit tricky. But then he grabbed my, you know, male friend Dharma teacher and did the same to him. You know, he was kissing him and hugging and just saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. It was just beautiful. It was so wonderful. So there he was facing death within a couple of days, actually. Yet he was full of love and he was full of care for me. As I left, he said, don't be sad, Radha, it's okay. It was just precious that in the face of something so difficult, he was caring about me and he was just radiant with love. This is the divinity of equanimity. Equanimity and metta together. So these things can really sustain us when we face the very difficult in life.
Okay, we're going to snatch a few minutes for one last question and apologies for those who didn't get their answer. What the Buddha means by liberated?
Just a small question.
What the Buddha means by liberated?
What the Buddha means by liberation is the cessation of greed, hatred, and delusion. The liberation comes through non-clinging. So not clinging to anything, anywhere, is the way of liberation. It's the path to liberation. So liberation is the cooling off. The Pali is Nibbana, and it literally means in Thailand to cool off. The rice Nibbanas, the rice cools off. So it's a cooling off of the mind. It's the cooling off of the greed, the hatred, and the delusion. This is the freedom. And when all of that cools off, what we know are the extraordinary and beautiful qualities of the heart, the compassion, the love, the joy, the equanimity. These divine and sublime qualities of the heart are the expression of the freedom.
Sounds good.
Anything to add, you two?
Just bow to the truth.
So thank you for your questions. Thank you for listening. It's now time for walking meditation. Yes, a note about tomorrow.
Tomorrow's schedule will be listed on your on the building's between 9:30 and 10. But because you're very curious, tomorrow starts the same as today. So 6:30 meditation, 7:15 the movement, and then the breakfast, and the rest of the day will be listed there.
Yes, and we meet in the hall after breakfast at 9:30 tomorrow.
Yeah, we have as the usual. Dana talk at 9:30. I think.
A sitting at 9:30.
And then we are scheduled to finish our arrangements here around 2 p.m. And. No. Oh. The carpool list will be hang on the message board tomorrow. No one will be left here without a ride home. Okay.
There's no need for anxiety about about anything. About packing your bag to leave. You've all packed a bag many, many times before. And there will be time to do everything. And so let the anxiety, put the anxiety to one side and really enjoy the time we have left together. It's precious. There's most of you have established at least some kind of focus and concentration and depth, and we have some time together. Retreat is not over yet. Take care. We love you.